Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Patrick Sullivan, president and CEO of OceanIt, a Hawaii-based company that's had an increasing presence here in Houston as it works with energy companies to use science-backed technologies to solve their biggest problems. Patrick joins the show today to discuss his company's wide range of innovations and why he's built out an innovative hydrogen-focused lab here in Houston. Patrick, thank you so much for joining me today. I should say aloha to you, seeing as you're based in Hawaii.
Thank you. Well, aloha back at you. And indeed, the question we get periodically is, why Hawaii? And the answer is relatively simple. My wife's from here, so not a complicated thing. But what we do at OceanIt is really what we call mind to market. So we think of things in fundamental science and drive them to market. So I started OceanIt almost 40 years ago. So that would make me an old fart. But I think it's kind of in a perpetual startup mode. We've done a variety of private equity finance spinouts, and we do lots of corporate co-development today. But we continue to do what we started out early on. We just keep growing. And it really starts with almost a philosophic conversation around what should we do and the kind of areas we think that are important. And we focus on thinking of those things. And so today we do a lot in energy, healthcare, aerospace, a lot in the information, AI space as well. But each one of those areas has its own kind of interesting niche in the market. But what they have that they all share is it really starts with this fundamental understanding of science and how it leads to technology. So for those that are interested, I put a book out a couple of years ago called Intellectual Anarchy that really reviews how we think. And so we are indeed in the middle of the sea, but we work around the world. So geography isn't really the key thing we focus on. But what we do in Houston is interesting because we consider Houston the center of energy. And energy makes the world go around. And I think there's just no two ways around it. And of course, there's lots of transition going on in the energy space. So it's an exciting time to be doing energy. But what we realized, and my own personal experience, spending a decade long, quite a while ago, on renewables, everything from OTEC, geothermal, wind, the world wasn't ready for that. So today, I think the world's in a different spot, especially with the urgency of climate. But what we've done is developed a very keen skill on developing or teasing out these really interesting things in science and then maturing them into the marketplace. And so what we do in Houston is a lot of meta-scale, which means we build things, we test things, we kind of bring them into the industrial world. And scale-up is one of those critical things that you've got to do. I think 90% of universities and national labs fail at this because they don't understand the cultural differences between doing things in fundamental research like a national lab and what it really takes to bring it to market. And the energy space is probably one of the best examples of what that means when you think of scale. And I tell people that are interested in energy, you know, spend an afternoon at the offshore technology conference and just walk the floor. I said, it's kind of like somebody shrunk you and you're looking at these massive machines and systems that move the world's energy. And I said, that's really what's happening with the world's energy, although most people don't really get that. But I said, so we have to be able to think like that too when we go to scale. And so what we do in Houston is we take things that we've developed in the labs here, and we spend time with the operators and the end users. So we work today with all the major energy companies around the world on bringing disruptive innovation to them so they can be more efficient, cheaper, they can transition, they can manage their costs. It's a wide range of things. The entry into this really for us was I think I would mark it with the blood of the Macondo well in the Gulf of Mexico, which was a massive disaster. And so I was there in Houston with the team from BP and their European team on the call as well. And it struck me that we're doing so much in technology already, particularly around Department of Defense, that we just got tons of really cool stuff we've already developed that we could then put to work in the energy space. So we started looking at that and started pivoting a lot of these applications to look at how to, you know, it's part of this energy transition story, because you're not going to turn things off tomorrow, but you can start transitioning. You can start, you know, there's a thing we're doing in power plants right now, for example, we call it dynamic decarbonization. It uses a nano treatment in heat exchangers, which are in every thermal power system on the planet, and makes them more efficient. I think we can save about 10% of their carbon, and we can do it immediately. So we developed an AI-driven robotic system to kind of do those sort of cleaning and treatments. And the early results from some of the work we did with direct seawater cooling, for example, didn't have to clean it for 5 or 6 years. Pretty remarkable, as opposed to every 3 to 6 months. So those are little examples, but turns out of huge consequence. So then you look at, you know, kind of dissecting the energy space between, you've got production, transmission, refining, and distribution. And we mapped out technology that we have that works in all those things. But a lot of the stuff we do starts with more basic kind of fundamental science questions. So it's not so much we start just thinking about energy as we start thinking about making an impact. So that's why the work we do in defense is so important, because we learn a lot about basic things that are, I think, so maybe risky or difficult that nobody would consider investing into them. Once we reduce that risk, then we start talking to end users in different spaces. But to get to that risk reduction, we spend a lot of time doing things that look like they're impossible. So for example, during the beginning of the pandemic, we had spent about, almost 8 years developing a human style AI based on linguistics. And then we pivoted that to this thing with a group called DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, on causality and biology. Wondering if you can look at cells that are have an intention based on what the genetics says. So it's a simple idea, but it's hard to do. If you take the American alphabet and say we got 26 symbols, symbols can be put together with infinite complexity to make you happy, sad, make a novel, a short paragraph. But a limited finite set of symbols becomes infinitely complex, depending on the combination. Likewise, we had the same idea around genetics. And so we learned to design molecules from scratch and then synthesize them. So that's what led to the test. But now you can take the same idea with that and apply it to energy and a whole bunch of other things too. So the platform is very fundamental. And you know, so that's a healthcare application, but you could argue for a whole bunch of other applications. And we're looking at teasing out critical information on performance of reservoirs using the same tools. You know, we call it grammar. So grammar is kind of it's almost like a parametric equation and how things behave. That's what we did with genetics. So we call it the grammar of RNA. But you create these tools and then you can apply them in a bunch of areas. So it sounds like a little bit of anarchy, hence the name of the book, Intellectual Anarchy. But it turns out they have a lot in common because the seeds, the fundamentals of these ideas can be shared in all these different fields. When you pivot back to the energy space, we've spent a lot of time developing techniques, for example, in military applications in energy. But if you take the same ideas and apply them to the production of hydrogen, now what you're looking at is a different way to produce hydrogen with directed energy than electrolysis, which has been around for what, 100, 200 years. So it's a whole new idea. And with that, you can also extract critical minerals and things because you don't have to clean up the water. You can just throw the energy in. And once you do that, it gives you all kinds of options.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good overview and it's a lot. Like, you are doing a lot of different technologies across industries. And I think it's very refreshing because you don't see that often. You see a company working within one industry, maybe one or two technologies, and really kind of zeroing in on those. But you're saying you've seen this success in tech first focus and then finding the right application for it across industries. So I want to talk about the hydrogen angle of that, because you've clearly identified a lot of potential within the hydrogen space. So I wonder, what do you see there, and then for opportunities to improve how we look at hydrogen and how we adapt it as a fuel source, as a cleaner fuel source?
Well, so it's an interesting question, because the way for it to work in the modern world, you have to then put it back into those kind of four buckets of E&P, transmission, refining, and distribution. You got to be able to produce it, right? Exploration and production is kind of a food category in the energy space, and a lot of people dedicated to just that. And so you have to be able to effectively produce it, but then you have to transmit it, right? So there's all kinds of ways to transmit it. We've been looking at things like producing ammonia by adding a nitrogen and then moving it as a liquid and then deconvolving it and pulling out the hydrogen or combusting the ammonia. There's a bunch of cool things going on in that space. But at the same time, we thought, okay, the U.S. has several millions of miles of methane pipelines. So if you just start looking at loading in hydrogen into those methane pipelines, you start displacing carbon. And there's all kinds of interesting trade-offs. But one of the challenges is in this area called embrittlement. What that means is hydrogen is a little molecule. And when you put it next to a metal, sometimes it likes to hide in the metal. And over time, sometimes it builds up and then it can crack that metal. And that's called hydrogen embrittlement. So people are worried about that. But it turns out we had developed a technology, again, for a military application we can do things to metal without embrittling them. And so we learned a lot about embrittlement over the last 5 years, what to do and what not to do by actually producing things and testing them and breaking them putting things into failure mode. So we thought, okay, if you take those, what we learned in the defense space, now you apply it over to energy. And you look at the pipelines. Now, by then, we had already been looking at and deploying a thing called DragX. It's a nanocomposite that we put in the pipelines with a pig. It's called a pig, but it's a machine that you shove through the pipeline, kind of like a big spit wide, except it lays down a very thin layer of material and protects the steel. And so it turns out reduces drag by about 25% and increases throughput by 15%. So we've been doing that for a while, and then we kind of meshed together the hydrogen work and said, okay, if we change the way we do this, we can now take a pipeline that you know, exist today, a piece of existing infrastructure, repurpose it using an AI-driven robotic pig, and now I can start adding hydrogen without embrittling the steel. So the cost is very, very low to do this kind of thing. But now I've got 3 million miles or so of pipeline I can use immediately, close to immediately. So we thought, okay, let's focus on this. But then you've got, you know, this facility we put together in Houston where it's a hydrogen hub test facility to look at embrittling steel with different mixtures of hydrogen and methane. And what we're trying to address there is that there's steel and there's steel. Not all steel is the same. And it turns out to an untrained observer, may not be a big deal, but if you're running a pipeline, you kind of want to know what your steel is about. And if you've got steel coming into the world that isn't as per spec, so you got all kinds of things. The thought we had was get samples and just test them. Put them through, you know, temperature, pressure, and mixtures of hydrogen and methane to show that they're safe with these treatments. And so we can test those to failure right there in Houston. So we're looking at now, we're talking to all the pipeline companies about getting parts of their steel pipe and running it through these tests to show how it's going to perform with these different mixtures so that you can safely then add hydrogen. But there wasn't any facility like this. Now, what this all kind of goes back to, you know, my earlier conversation around mind to market. So these are fundamental science ideas applied to markets, in this case, the energy space, which is a massive, massive area. But we're bringing ideas that are somewhat disruptive. So we're not doing all the traditional things that everybody's done for a long time. And I think that's what's called for today. But what that means then is that we've got to run these issues to ground with a lot of detail and rigor. And we're doing that. And so, you know, we present some of the findings at things like the Offshore Technology Conference and some of the different energy conferencing events. But the idea is to kind of get the community to see that when you integrate technology from different fields into the energy space, you can keep making progress. So the energy transition, again, from using fossil fuel to, you know, somewhere in the future, 100% renewable, it's going to take time. But if we start reducing carbon and the use of fossil fuel today, we buy time for the planet. So it's kind of like a burning platform. And I think at the same time, you know, we're looking at things like sequestering carbon, capturing carbon. There's a whole bunch of things going on in that space. There's a couple of companies out there that have made big announcements. And, you know, all that's going to contribute. Right, it's not just one answer. It's going to be multiple touches to this problem to come up with a way to transition. In addition to, you know, mind you, understanding the weather better. You know, weather is an interesting problem. I used to live below this massive computer in Boulder, Colorado, that was dedicated to weather. So National Center for Atmospheric Research. And I actually, many years ago, worked on some of the CO2 data. And what's interesting is that because we do all these computer simulations and models and things, is if you look at their weather model, which is a fabulous model, and then the European model and another model, they don't all work together. You know, there's a little bit of voodoo in the weather as well. And I think shaking out those things to get a better causal connection in weather, as opposed to the correlation we have today, will give us some insights about potentially engineering the climate as well. So all those things need to be on the table. And we're interested in all of them. We're kind of dabbling in a variety of them, but in the energy space directly and what we're doing in Houston, it's very important because we're doing, we call it metascale, scale up. And so that's working out all the details so that you can go to massive scale. But you do this, we call Metascale there, because as it turns out, it's one thing to have a whole bunch of bright PhDs working on things and they do some pretty cool work. But unless you spend a lot of time with the real world and the guys that are out there building things and the guys that are running things, and you spend time with them and listen to what's going on, you're not going to really understand the market. So what we do at OceanIt, and I talk about this in the book, we have the blue zone, which is kind of deep science zone, and then the green zone, which is all about products impacting humans and society, scale up, manufacturing, and they're connected to the rock and roll zone. Because to go from one to the other, it's a lot of work. So what we do in Houston is we do a lot of listening with all these major companies. They come over all the time and look at stuff. We test things with them. We do projects with them, because understanding, just because you got a cool technology doesn't mean you're going to do anything unless you understand the market, the people, the end users. It's really essential. And in the energy space, as much as people wish it would just change its ways overnight, it ain't going to happen. But what I found is most of the people we're working with see the need to change and want to be more efficient, cleaner, and all the things that you might imagine a reasonable person would want to do to make the world a little better. Most of these guys are on board with that, especially these big companies. And they're investing in these areas, and we're collaborating with them on a whole bunch of things. So it's kind of exciting, because I think it was Shell that was telling me that, this is a few years back, I think we were in Brazil working on a project, and they said, we're not really in the petroleum business, we're in the energy business. And in 100 years, we're still going to be in the energy business. Just maybe a different kind of energy. And I thought, okay, it kind of captures it. You know, you still got the things that go on in the energy space today, but there's a lot of transition going on too.
Well, a lot of what you just said really resonates, I think, with me and probably with listeners too, this idea that, you know, the energy transition, there's no one silver bullet, you know, there's not one technology that's going to revolutionize the space. And, you know, I did want to talk about the hydrogen accelerator, which you brought up, that you opened in Houston earlier this year. And I think, what I'm hearing is your presence in Houston, and you said it, you're listening in Houston. So you're working with companies here in Houston. What are they saying? You touched a little bit about how they've thought of the energy transition and Shell specifically, but what are you hearing from these collaborators, in some cases, I'm sure, customers? What are they most interested in, and how are you addressing their biggest concerns?
Well, and so what we've learned to do, for example, one of the big areas is around nanotechnology. So we started this thing several years back, actually with the military again. We called it industrial applications in nanotechnology. And what that means is harsh environments, temperatures, pressures, all kinds of things. This was really focused on military. But then you take the same ideas and apply them into energy. So what we're doing is we're listening on some of these problems. So take, for example, methane hydrates, you know, or kind of step back. The thing we did with fantastic results was around the cement steel bonding downhole. So if you look at the failure in the Gulf of Mexico, the Macondo well, the steel cement separation was a big thing. So we produced a nano treatment that improved that bond strength by 100%. And we built a factory there in Houston I think they were supporting Shell, BP, and Chevron or something in the Gulf and some of these pretty aggressive wells. Because it improved the bond strength that much, increased the reliability. But now they're talking about using the same technology. Again, it's a nanotechnology to sequester carbon, because then if you do this right, it won't leak. You really hold it in the reservoir tightly because of this nano treatment. And that's just one thing. And so what we're finding is we're able to manipulate the surfaces of materials to do different strange things. So think of a couple dials, you turn them right and left and say, well, let's try this feature or this feature. So when it comes to the methane hydrates, for example, we have been testing in the hydrate lab there at Colorado School of Mines for probably, well, several years. Outstanding results, where we change the surface energy of the actual tubulars. It's relatively inexpensive too. That's the interesting thing. And stuff doesn't stick. So the methane hydrates don't end up accumulating and blocking systems and blowing things up. And that was the whole point of that lab there they set up at School of Mines. So what we're getting from our customers is they're really excited to work with us because they don't meet many companies that are so kind of out of the box in what they how they think. Part of that, I think, my sense is that because we got people all over the mainland and we're working all over the world, but as being located in Hawaii, we kind of start with a blank piece of paper. And we don't make geography the central issue. So that means we're trying not to over bias our opinions early on, which means better listening and then better understanding. So when you have some of these big institutions, especially the big energy companies, they spend tons of money on a problem, but everybody keeps looking at it exactly the same way over and over and over. And we look at it in a different way. Like I won't mention the name of the company, but it's one of the big energy companies. And the guy said, I've been asking this question for 20 years and I keep getting the same answer. That was improving the bond strength thing. It's a technology called skin. And it was pretty much off the chart. So we developed a bunch of fans because of that. And then what we've been doing is once a year during part of OTC, we do a tech showcase. And we just kind of bring stuff we're working on and set it up and show people and talk about it. And it's kind of interesting because you just never see things quite like this. And yet we're working on these things. Maybe there's a medical application or a defense application or you know, we do lots of work in aerospace avionics and that kind of thing. And yet you can take what that learning and apply it to another industry. So we end up just kind of sharing some of these things we're doing and really been interesting because we get a huge crowd of people that want us to help them with some of their big problems. Well, what they're trying to do, again, you know, economics is always a big issue, reduce their cost, reduce the risk, increase reliability. And then when it comes to things like capturing and sequestering carbon, for example, we got some really interesting technologies and materials where it's not just building active wells, but when they plug in abandoned wells, there's a ton of interest in that where, you know, we call it metamaterial. These are look like grains of sand, but they're smart. We can design and manufacture them. And we're manufacturing, we call it, again, metascale level in Houston, and turn a well into a sensor, turn a material or an installation into something it wasn't, nobody imagined it would be. So you have it speaking to you on a regular basis on how it's doing or how the geology is doing with these kind of sensing materials. So we develop them maybe in like in the sensing material, we might have started out in the defense space making some pretty interesting things. And then once you go into the energy space, again, the idea of scale blows up. So we went from cupfuls we made in Honolulu to half-ton pickup loads in Houston, which we then deployed into some wells and did some really interesting tests. And then we're on our way to producing freight car loads. And but the metascale we developed there in Houston works out all the key pieces so that gives you scalability. It also gives you really important economic value or advantages. So for example, on the metamaterial, we might have said, okay, early on it's $10,000 a gram. That's kind of expensive. But now we can make it for, you know, under a thousandth of that, right? I mean, there's a huge scale effect you get when you, and cost benefits you get when you go to scale. And it's hard to get those things without spending time with the people that are working in those industries that really suffer the consequence when it fails, that really are trying to solve the problem. And we spend time trying to listen and understand, but we take a fresh set of eyes to a lot of these problems.
Well, I think that's very valuable, and taking a technology and then building it out and then finding a way for it to impact an industry or a unique problem. Like you've talked about a lot of very specific problems that, you know, most of us listening don't have any experience in. But it's like you started with the science-backed technology and you found the application. So my question is, you know, once you develop that out, you found a solution for a problem that a customer is interested in, what's your business model on providing that technology? Is it from a service capacity, rolling out into a new company? I'm curious how that works.
Well, it's a really good question. It is in itself a hard problem. So we've done private equity finance spinouts. There's pros and cons to that. What we've learned is that the more disruptive something is, the longer you got to stay with it. And so that means if a lot of universities, for example, they make a cool thing and they throw it over the fence and then it just fails. It happens all the time. And the problem with that is because you're doing it so different, people might take it on the other side of the fence and say, well, let me make it like what I already know. And that's usually what kills it. Because if it's doing something that's really unique and you're trying to make it like everything else, you basically kill the thing about it that was really interesting. And you have this, I talk about it a little bit in the book, but this groupthink kind of a problem where somebody who's been in the field who looks at it and keeps saying, well, you know, you may call it X, but we still think it's Y, and they keep treating it that way, and then it doesn't do what they want. So we do now, especially in the energy space, a lot of, we call it corporate co-development. So we put together industry partnerships, and we work together to scale something and share in the economics on it. And that way, we almost become, you know, like inside these companies to understand what they're really up against. And it's not, so that what's interesting about this approach is that it kind of disintermediates venture capital. So there's three flavors of risk, just at a high level: technology risk, execution risk, and market risk. 50% of the risk is always found kind of in the market, in our case. And so when we work with these big companies, we're really reducing that market risk, because we're trying to do it in a way that works for them. And so once you create a technology, you have to then find a way to get it to work with the industry you're trying to work with and support. And what's interesting is that each industry has its own culture. And each major, especially in the energy space, each company has its own culture. So the Shell, they're Dutch, Eni, they're Italian. You know, the way they go about doing business is they share a lot of things, but they're different. And so you not only need to understand the culture of energy, but to be effective, to really go to scale. If you got somebody that's working, like there's a group, we have an agreement, we're working in 67 countries, but it's a European company. And there's a culture that's informed by where the company is from. And we're trying to be sensitive to that as well as the industry. So it's kind of interesting, because that's when I talk about scale, you have to be able to think on a global scale if you want to roll something out, if you're really trying to make a difference. So it's interesting, because then back to your question, when we do, so a lot of people jump into this idea of venture capital. Now, if you look at venture capital and put a map together of the U.S., there's very little venture capital in a place like Hawaii. It turns out there's not much in Houston either. You might argue there's some in Austin, but most of it's in, you know, Silicon Valley, up by Boston. Is it just maybe a handful of regions in the United States that have venture capital. Most places don't. But you have to look at venture capital as one tool in the toolbox. And we learned this from some work we did with Chevron, where a guy who worked for the CEO was working with us, and he said, we don't need their capital, and they're just a distraction, because these guys, the VC guys, kept showing up at the meeting, so they just dismissed them and said, look, we're just going to do this, so don't worry about them. Let's just focus. I thought, that's interesting. So there's a lot of focus in the startup scene on venture, but you do need to be able to finance things. So it's not that you don't need any, but it's a little overemphasized. And what you're really trying to do is use capital to reduce different kinds of risk. And so we found that corporate co-development is a really good way to reduce market risk without using venture capital. It's a risk mitigation strategy, but it actually works for us quite well, because most of these companies are not trying to steal what we do. They want to solve their problems, and they want to encourage us to go to scale. And so if you need more capital or whatever, they're generally there saying, yeah, we're in. And so it's kind of interesting, because what's driving them is solving the hard problem, which has massive economic consequences to their businesses. So the economics then of supporting these kinds of ideas is kind of a rounding error for them. For us, it's a big deal. But it's how we're able to reduce the market risk and kind of keep the technology maturing.
I think it's very interesting. It's almost like you're providing innovation as a service to your customers. You know, you have the technology, you work hand in hand to develop it. I wonder, just to kind of wrap up, you've talked about a bunch of different technology that you've worked on. When you look to the future, what do you think, and this is whether you tackle this challenge or you just see it out there, but what do you think is going to be the most disruptive next big thing within tech? And is it something you're going to focus on?
Well, the answer to the last part's easy, yes, because we're in the middle of a bunch of those things. It's a really interesting question. There's so much going on right now. It's a really exciting time in the tech space. And the reason is because I think the world has kind of been asleep at the switch for a while in terms of real technology, because, you know, lots of app development was really good. So now you can order pizza, you can order a taxi on your phone. You can do a lot of those things. But the idea of real innovation, making things, you know, producing energy and transmitting information, there's so many really interesting things in the actual, we're building a technology space. It's a really exciting time. But one of the things we've put a lot of time and effort into is an area which we call anthropomorphic artificial intelligence, so AI. And the reason is that large language models are definitely entertaining. I don't know if you've had a chance to play with ChatGPT, tons of applications too, but it's still kind of brittle. Large language models have got their pros and cons. This approach is based on Chomsky and grammar. And Chomsky was a professor at MIT. We've been working with Noam Chomsky for now, like 7-8 years. But he developed the mathematics of linguistics using the idea of human cognition as linguistic competency. So that, for example, when you speak, you're mathematically efficient. It's not random. It's just how human brains are put together. So we built a system based on that hypothesis. And so we're spending a lot of time on that. But think of humans are good in edge cases, small data, that kind of thing. That's where we've been spending a lot of time. Now, having said that, we still are doing a ton of work in, you know, deep learning and machine learning, and we're playing around with some of these large language models, but they're kind of wacky. So I think, though, all together, it's going to impact things. And I don't think people quite understand how, but I do think it's kind of exciting. So that's definitely there. I think the reason it's going to get more airtime too is because the social consequences of, and the political consequences of disinformation, misinformation. I mean, for example, we've been experimenting with this. So we had our guys write a proposal or a conference paper using chat, and it sounds really good, but you know, they literally made stuff up and they made up the authors. The authors don't even exist, they're not even people. It's so convincing. It's scary. And because the guys working on these papers, they're experts in the field, so they kind of know the literature and everything. But the way it's done is kind of mind-blowing, because it's like, wow, it sounds so good, but it's bullshit. So that's going to happen. On the other hand, climate is this undeniable thing, and we've got to figure out how we're going to deal with it. So I think it's going to run the gamut of, obviously, energy transformation, new sources of energy, and even geoengineering. Now, I know that's a scary idea, but understanding how the planet is working and what to do about it, these are big things that we need to think of as a society. I mean, just the one thing, for example, when the Gulf of Mexico gets hot and the Gulf Stream, the water there in the Gulf was so hot this summer. But what it does is the Gulf Stream going up north is what makes Iceland green and Greenland icy. So when that starts acting up, those big climates, those, you know, things are going to change, and maybe not in the way we want to see it. And so what do we do about it? Well, on the one hand, we could say there's nothing we could do, but I don't agree. I think we need to be thinking deeply about these questions, and I think they're important, and we're going to learn a lot in the process. And I kind of ended on this note of, in the 70s, there was a book called, it was by the Club of Rome, Limits of Growth, and it was how the world is going to starve. And this is before genetics made a big impact on farming, agriculture. And when I was a student, that was a big deal, because people are really, you know, look at all the graphs, you say, okay, that's when the world ends. And the world didn't end because of science and engineering. And so I'm a kind of a believer that somehow if humans can get out of their own way, we can solve these problems too.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we really ran the gambit on tech and the variety of different innovations. But yeah, it does all come back to AI and climate. So that was a really great place to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure learning about what you're doing and your impact here in Houston, and such an interesting way of kind of approaching innovation. So thanks for sharing.
Thank you. And I would say we're recruiting young PhDs in physics, chemistry, material science, AI, math. So we'll be visiting a bunch of different universities there. We work with several, spent time, a lot of time at Rice with some of the folks there, but we'll be looking for people that are interested in being part of this journey.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.